Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 375. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to Ken at thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowisogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in thisshowisogay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. It is story time, listeners. It is story time. Let me tell you a story. Here's what happened. Last Sunday, I walked down to Edgewater Park right here in Cleveland, Ohio. It is just a beautiful space that looks right out on Lake Erie, which I think is actually an ocean because you can't see the other side, and that's what I think an ocean is. Anyway, I brought with me a book called It Looks Like This. I had not started reading it yet. It had been on my couch for a few days and brought it down to the water with me. I opened it. I started reading about 11 a.m. At some point, I walked the mile and a half back to my house, never looking up because I just kept right on reading. I made it onto my couch. I kept right on reading. At some point, I think my partner talked to me, but I'm not really sure because I was reading. And then at some point in the early evening, I finished the whole flipping book, and that was my whole Sunday reading It Looks Like This. Here to talk all about the book and to compensate me for the day he now owes me is the book's author, Rafi Mittelfeldt. Rafi has worked as a reporter for a small town newspaper in Central Texas. He has freelanced as a theater critic when he's not working in book publishing. It Looks Like This is his debut novel, and it has been so absurdly well-reviewed, including being chosen by the American Booksellers Association as one of their Indies Introduced picks for summer/fall 2016 season. More accolades are surely on their way, but first, Rafi, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You owe me a day.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to pay you back for that.
All right, we'll do this interview and call it even. We have so much ground to cover, sir. Are you ready?
Yes.
It seems to me that all roads for you at some point lead back to Texas. Talk to our listeners about growing up right outside of Houston, Texas.
Yeah, so it was a suburb of Houston, kind of in the southeast, Clear Lake. And it was, I mean, I didn't really have a frame of reference, you know, for anything to compare it to, because I'd lived there pretty much all of my aware life. You know, it's not that it was like, it's a crazy, you know, conservative place or anything, but it's definitely more conservative than average. And I only realized that when I first went to college at the University of Texas in Austin. And so suddenly I was like, oh, wait, this is something to compare it to. You know, this is a more liberal and inviting place.
Now, little high school Rafi, he was not president of the high school's Gay Straight Alliance.
No, there wasn't a Gay Straight Alliance, at least not that I'm aware of.
We're going to go back and look.
I only knew like one or two gay kids there.
I was reading a blog that you wrote for Barnes & Noble. I was reading about your experience with Luis and another student named Luis telling someone else that he was gay. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is my creative writing class senior year of high school, and it was like the first period, and we all kind of like had this great relationship with the teacher, and it was, you know, this sort of like this fun creative class, and so we'd get there early in the morning and just kind of hang out and wait for class to start. And so one day when I got there, Luis was telling this other kid, Noah, you know, I kind of like just caught the middle of the conversation that he was gay, and I immediately was just thinking like, okay, this is just a joke, because Noah was, you know, a couple years younger than us, and so he was kind of like tended to be the butt of well-meaning jokes. And so I was just like, oh, they're just joking, you know, just like trying to pull another one on Noah. And so Noah like looked at me as he walked in, as I walked in, and he's like, Rafi, did you know that Luis was gay? And I said, yeah, Noah, everyone knows. You know, I'm just playing along.
Right.
And then it kind of kept going on, and I was waiting for this punchline. And then it just never came. And then suddenly I was like, wait, you know, I started looking at everyone else in the room and at Luis. And that's when I realized that he wasn't joking. And I just didn't know. And everyone else did, you know. I mean, of course, I didn't say anything then because I was a little embarrassed to have been out of the loop myself. But it was this moment where I was like, holy crap, there's someone who is, you know, just is being open about being gay. And I wasn't at all. I was totally closeted. So he was like the first one who I could actually like see and see how people responded to him.
And then, by the way, I enjoy the end of the story where he's not so gay anymore.
Yeah, that was, you know, like the great thing about Facebook is that it lets you reconnect with people who you kind of thought you would never see or hear from again. And so one day, you know, I'd been thinking about Luis off and on for years, you know, just thinking about like how strange it was that he was out. Not strange, but like kind of amazing, you know, and remarkable. And so I finally, I tracked him down. I looked him up and I just sent him this message. And I was just like, hey, you know, I just want to see how you're doing. Just to let you know, I always thought it was so awesome that you were comfortable being out that early. And you know, I only came out the next year when we were in college. And he responded in this really, like really kind of cheerful and I think kind of self-aware way where he said, oh, I'm actually not gay anymore. I decided that that's not what God wanted for me. And, you know, like I had this difficult period in my life where I was looking for answers and finally I found it in this church. But, you know, God told me I had to put that part of my life behind me. And he was saying it in this way. He was really cheerful in his message. And he was trying to say it, you know, like, I'm not trying to convert anyone. I don't think that's the right way to do it. I just wanted to be honest. But I just didn't know how to respond to it. It kind of, you know, took me aback. Like on one hand, I was like, I just want whatever makes him happy, but I can't imagine that is real happiness.
Yeah, yeah. It stuck for you, though. The gay part stuck for you.
Yeah, yeah. That was just one of those, I never looked back, you know?
Yeah. And then you moved to New York City, and you're writing in New York City. For how long had this book been kicking around in your head?
I don't remember the moment that it started, but it was, I think the first time I wrote anything was in 2009.
Okay.
And it was just with the description of a sunrise, and that you know, that scene kind of becomes central throughout the story. And I had, it was just because I had kind of gotten Mike, the main character, in my head, and he's this, you know, as you know, this super awkward, kind of stilted, withdrawn kid, and I wanted to see the world through his eyes and his very kind of like stark descriptions of everything. And then to see him kind of like navigate his own coming out through that lens.
I have to say my favorite line in the entire book. I always get nervous quoting a line towards the start of the book because people are going to think he didn't read the whole thing. I read the whole thing and we're going to talk about that. But right at the start of the book, Mike says, I don't mind that he's awkward because I know I am too. And then I was thinking, oh, I love you, Mike.
Yeah, I that line stuck for me too. I really liked it when I was writing it. And it's just because, so you know, this is Mike talking about his friend Jared, who is kind of very, also very awkward, but seems to have doesn't really have a problem with, I guess, self-confidence. He just doesn't really seem to care what people think about him.
Yeah.
And so in that way, he's different from Mike.
But before we go any further, we should tell everyone this is a YA book. And I never know how to feel about that. Am I not supposed to be reading this book? I think one could argue that I'm not the ideal YA demographic anymore.
Well, I think the thing about young adult is that it's become a broader, I don't know, thing. It used to be kind of very just like explicitly for teens. Now there seems to be a lot more crossover. I don't know if that's necessarily by design. I think it's just kind of at some point became more socially acceptable for adults to read YA.
Okay.
You know, like that, like Hunger Games was a big thing that did it, and Harry Potter, of course.
So it's okay that I was very angsty.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
But it's also, no, it's totally great for adults to read YA, and especially something like this, because I think, you know, I think some adults could benefit from reading this.
Yeah. Well, let's back up a step. For our listeners who have not heard about this text, and I will be urging everyone multiple times throughout the course of this chat to go out and get it, because, again, you will lose a Sunday, and he will pay you back in some way. I probably shouldn't introduce that concept. But tell everyone the general pitch of It Looks Like This.
Okay. So it is, you know, as I said, it's about Mike, who is this 15, he's 14 going on 15. He's a high school freshman. He's very, you know, as I said, awkward and withdrawn, kind of, you know, into himself, and doesn't really know how to act around people. He lives in this very socially conservative family, and then one day he kind of realizes that he has this crush on this new boy named Sean. And much to his surprise, it kind of seems that Sean likes him back. And so, you know, he's going totally against his nature pursuing this or you know, going for it. But then everything kind of falls apart very suddenly and very terribly.
Yeah.
And then so Mike has to kind of like learn how, you know, what kind of life he wants for himself as opposed to what life he thinks other people want for him.
I'm sure the question you've been asked before, I suspect you will be asked it quite a bit from here on out. How much of you is in this book?
I love getting this question because it gives me an opportunity to tell everyone how great my parents are.
Yay!
You know, it's funny, when you're writing your debut novel, you know, you're just kind of like writing whatever, like whatever you want, and you're not really giving any thought to the consequences, I guess, of it being read by strangers and by a wider audience. And then so once it became clear that it was going to be published, like my first thought was like, oh God, everyone's going to think my parents are terrible. because Mike's parents aren't great, but my parents are actually wonderful. They've been supportive my whole life. I dedicated the book both to them and to my parent-in-laws because they are also great to my husband, Damien. So really, like the part of me that's in there, aside from just kind of general gay experience and being a gay teen and having to kind of like navigate that, Mike's personality is sort of like an amplification of a part of me, especially from high school, because it took me a long time to learn that I really kind of needed to live life for myself and not for others, and that's still something that I'm kind of still learning.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out.
We're all working on that, buddy. We're all working on that. Let's do a little learning annex with Rafi. Talk to us about the craft. Was there a place where you consistently found yourself writing? How did you carve out the time to get this done?
I am not as good or as consistent as a lot of other writers as far as like finding a spot or a time. I would just kind of write when I... It's sort of like, the hardest part is for any writing session is starting. And then once you start, you can kind of generally do it. But then I would sometimes go months without. Part of that is because, you know, when you're writing your debut, you're not writing it for anyone else. So there are no deadlines except
right.
for the ones you give yourself. And if you're like me, you're not very disciplined. so you take forever. So since then, I've kind of learned to kind of try to make a routine, like have a certain time of day where I'll write maybe for an hour. And just an hour, you know, after a while can kind of build into something.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. You wrote this in a Huffington Post piece because, can we argue, by the way, it's not exactly, is it fair to say the book is not all sunshine and rainbows? Is that fair to say without giving away too much?
Yes, that is fair. So in that Huffington Post article that you're referencing, you know, I talk a lot about gay tragedies, and this one certainly falls into that, but I also I see it as still kind of a hopeful book. I talk very generally about tragedies as a broad genre, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, this one definitely has some sad elements to it.
You wrote this, quote, LGBT literature is not a zero-sum game. When there's an imbalance in the types of stories available, we must call that out. But the solution is never to reduce one kind. It's to increase others. There are not too many gay tragedies. There are too few upbeat gay stories. Were there points in the book where you were thinking, I would like to make this happier, but it's just not the way it goes?
It's more that I was just writing the story that had come to me and the one that I think kind of grew naturally from the main character, Mike. You really just went, especially I think when you're writing your first book, you really just write what comes to you naturally. And, you know, if that becomes published, it's great. And if not, then you move on to another project and then see what happens.
Yeah.
Again, listeners, we are here with Rafi Mittelfeldt. We are talking about his debut novel, It Looks Like This. Let's talk about some random ephemera, stuff that I know that you enjoy about this book. We love the cover, and I know that you love the cover, too.
Oh, my God, I love the cover.
Talk to us about the evolution of the cover.
Well, so, I mean, it was actually the first draft or version of it that I saw. So the cover designer, his name is Matt Roser. You know, like the way he was kind of explaining it is that he wanted a graphic representation of the sunrise that's described in the first two pages, as opposed to just like a literal representation, because, you know, just the graphic one, I think, just from a design standpoint, seemed like a better idea. And then each stripe, so you know, like the cover is stripes of different colors mentioned in the sunrise. So then each stripe, you know, is kind of textured in a way that it sort of looks like old comic print, you know, like all the little multicolored circles that make up a more solid color. And so his explanation of that was that, you know, like from far away, it looks like a solid color, but as you get close, you see that it's more complicated, sort of like Mike and Sean, and even Victor, the bully.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I would recommend this book for anyone except one particular population. I would say, and I'm not usually in the habit of warning people off books, but if we have listeners who are devotees, big fans of quotation marks, this might not be the book for them.
Yes. Yes. I think that's a totally fair thing. But yeah, so there are no quote marks in the dialogue.
That was an intentional choice on your part.
Yeah, and it's not something I ever expected I would do, but you know, like it kind of goes back to Mike and his personality, you know, so it's first person in his perspective. And everything he describes and everything he says is done in a very kind of like simple, no frills way. And the quotation marks was a part of that, you know, so like all the dialogue is like, he says, blah, 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 blah. I say, blah, 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 blah. And there are no quote, because in my thinking, Mike is, you know, it's like it's hard enough for him to get the content of what he wants to say across, because he's just, communication is not really his forte. That, you know, without him worrying, having to worry about stylization and punctuation or anything like that, like I don't think Mike would have any interest in or knowledge of how to communicate in a more sophisticated way.
Okay. Again, listeners, if you are just, you need your quotation marks in order to get through a text, you are the only people I think maybe should not purchase this, or maybe you should and you should work through that. That would be okay. That would be okay. And then without question, I might be a little off the beaten path here, but the breakout star of the book is unquestionably Trooper Mansky, if only just for his name.
Yeah. So that's, I feel like there are a lot of things in this that I didn't realize at the time that are, just kind of like quirks of writing your first book, and not really ever thinking about it as being read by a wider audience. So I borrowed a couple names from people, and so Trooper Mansky was one of them. It's my very close friend Nate Mansky, and you know, of course, Nick Mansky, his brother, and also my friend. So you know, Mansky just sort of shows up in the book out of nowhere, and I didn't really think about that until much later. I was like, oh God, Nate's going to be in this book.
And long time listeners of our show should know Nate Mansky and Nick Mansky, because they were both on the show, gosh, years and years ago. We're talking 4 or 5 years ago, which brings us to, because you do have a shout out in the acknowledgments to I'm From Driftwood, and you've done a lot of work for I'm From Driftwood. For folks who don't know about that amazing group of folks, tell everybody about I'm From Driftwood.
Yeah, so IFD, I'm From Driftwood, is Nate's nonprofit organization that since March 2009, actually almost about when I started writing this, and since March 2009 has been collecting and sharing stories by LGBT people from all over the world. And then he has a map that sort of shows where every story is. And it's not just coming out stories, it's just everyday stories, anything related to being gay or lesbian or bi or trans or anything queer. And the idea is to show, you know, especially youth, that they're not alone. Like if they're stuck in the middle of Kansas, and they don't think they know anyone, you know, within 6 or 20 miles who's gay or who's going through what they're going through, there's going to be a story on IFD, on I'm From Driftwood, that they can actually relate to, because it's, chances are there's someone from Kansas who went through the same thing.
Talk to me about what responses you have received thus far. The book is out in the world. People can get their hands on it, which means that you, I'm sure, are getting some feedback. What are you hearing out there?
I think the ones that mean the most to me are the ones from teens.
Yeah.
Who, you know, like, so, they will, there was one who said, like, oh, God, I'm reading this and I love it. Boy, it sure is sad, though. I'm like, I know, I'm so sorry, but... you know, like aside from teens, there have also been some, older people who said, oh God, I wish I'd been able to read this when I was a kid. So I'm hoping that it appeals to both adults and teens, but I really do love hearing from younger people about it.
Someone gets their hands on the book, they finish the book, they close it. What do you want them to walk away with? This is one of those rare moments where you get to actually tell people what you want them to take away from it.
I think it kind of depends who is reading it. So if it's someone who is, if it's a teen, I want them to either think like, okay, wow, this does still happen, even if it doesn't happen to me, because my hope is that, you know, like this kind of homophobic bullying is on the rarer side now than it was, say, 20 years ago. Or if it is still happening, excuse me, to them, to think, okay, I'm not alone. You know, almost kind of the same thing that I think I'm From Driftwood is so good about, kind of offering that implied empathy and validation. If it's someone who is older, I would hope that it shows them that this is still happening and that they are now in a position of power to actually do something about it, whether they are a parent, you know, like you got to listen to your kids and pay attention to them and understand that something that you may think is the right course can actually be extremely destructive to them.
Something for everyone. What is coming up for you next? What do we work on now?
I'm writing a second book. I'm not allowed to say too much about it.
But okay.
In very general terms, it's about a teen who finds out an awful secret about his, you know, long dead father at the same time that his whole town finds out. And so he's kind of like dealing with this exposed family secret and what it means to him while becoming a pariah in his town.
And how big of a part will Trooper Mansky have in that second book?
Trooper Mansky does not yet have a cameo. I guess
okay.
I could just throw him in there somewhere, but but probably not.
Oh, I think that would be an incredible device to just carry that character through all of your work. It's very exciting. It's very exciting. Let's give some audience to all of our budding writers out there. You know, people have these ideas floating around in their head, and there exists that gap between things being in your head and being on paper, and then certainly being on paper and getting out there to the world. How can we help people navigate through the entirety of that process?
This is going to sound so unhelpful, but I think just the cool kind of like stick-to-itness is a lot more important than I realized, because it is so easy when you don't have someone on the other end, you know, who's reading it or a promise to read it. It's so easy to just kind of like sit on these things and never finish them or let them idle and let them die. So really, you know, like I would, if you are still in the process of writing, make sure that you carve out that time that I didn't, you know, give yourself an hour every day, write until you're done, and then just kind of keep pushing it out there to, you know, so normally the process is you submit to literary agents first, and then they will sign you up, and then they send it out to the publishers. It can be difficult and daunting to get an agent, but it's important to kind of stick to that, and also do some research. Look those agents up. Make sure that they are a good fit. I got one who was a very good fit, and that was because I, you know, did a lot of like research online and didn't just submit to anyone.
How many different drafts did your husband read of this before the final one?
Just one, and an old one too. It was one that where the second half was very different and much worse. And then a friend of mine read it and made some edits. So my husband Damien read that same one, but a friend of mine also read it. You know, made some editing suggestions, and then I sat on it for a year and a half because that's what I did. And then I made those changes, and then that's when I was able to get it out.
And I would imagine it was a pretty proud moment when your family finally read it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's, you know, my family isn't the most expressive. So when they say, you know, when my dad, he posted on Facebook because he was at a bookstore event in Houston when I went down. And it was just a picture of me reading, and the caption was simply, you know, my younger son, Rafi, reading from his book, "It Looks Like This. I will never forget this moment." And just reading that, it stunned me. It still kind of stuns me whenever I read, because, you know, we're not expressive, and so I know it's meant.
Last question for you, sir. Talk to me about that moment for you when the package arrived. I have it in my head, this package arrived, and you weren't quite sure what it was going to be, and you had not been having a great day. I have a whole narrative that I have about when this all happened. Tell everybody about what actually happened when you had it in your hands.
You mean the final finished book?
Yes.
It came earlier than I expected, and it was actually left out on the doorstep because I never really trust our local post office. But I had already left for work, and then so my husband left after me to go to work, and then he saw it just like on the porch or whatever. And picked it up and took a picture of, and you know, this is just the package that contains the two books. And so he took a picture of just the package and sent it to me. And I was immediately like, oh my God, I think that's the finished copy. It's so much earlier than I was expecting. And so I, you know, like for the whole first morning, for the whole first half of the day, I was just like kind of excited and like waiting until lunch so I could meet up with my husband, you know, for his company, of course, but also to get that book. So, you know, and then so I opened it, and it was surreal in a way that around me life was just kind of still going on, but it felt like such an enormous moment in this very small contained geographical area of, you know, the space inhabited by myself and my husband.
Oh, so great. I love when things like this happen to great people. Listeners, this is what you guys need to do. Strolling over to anywhere fine books are sold. You can get it on Amazon, wherever you need to get it. Again, the name of the book is It Looks Like This. You can stroll on over to Rafi's website, rafimitt.com, and learn more about him and the forthcoming Trooper Mansky book, which I want a part of, but I think it's coming. I think it's coming.
Yeah,
I will tell you this, sir. Yes, I spent that entire Sunday reading your book, and it was an incredible confluence of just sitting down by the water, because I didn't actually know what was going to be on the first couple pages. So to be sitting on a rock, just completely facing the water, and to encounter water right at the start of the book I knew I was in for it. But I want to talk to you about my experience at the end of the book, which I will not reveal for people in any way, shape, or form. But I will say that I was on the couch. My partner was a few rooms away in the office doing his own schoolwork, and I knew I only had maybe 6 or 7 pages left, and I just kind of yelled out for him, and I said, I'm going to need you to come over here, and he trotted over, and he's like, what's the problem? I said, I just kind of need you to put your arm around me as I'm reading the last 6 or 7 pages of the book, mm-hmm. And he did that, and it was really kind of what I needed at that point, and it paired so well with just a very fulfilling literary experience. And so it certainly brought us closer together. So thank you for that. And we won't charge you for that therapy. But also was one of those experiences where I closed a book and thought, well, that was just a really great experience that I had. And I'm quite appreciative. And you provided that.
Oh, well, thank you. That's such a beautiful description of reading the last few pages.
There you go. That's what happened. Again, listeners, It Looks Like This. Go pick it up. Rafi, we are expecting and look forward to so much more, sir.
Thank you so much.
Don't tell me you don't know what love is when you're old enough to know that.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have tons of time left on this week's episode, so let's get to all of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. I don't know if you all saw, there was an interview with a gay couple at a Donald Trump rally earlier this week, and it took place right here in Ohio, right here in the Rust Belt. And these two gentlemen, this gay couple, they were articulating all the different reasons that they support Donald Trump. And do I agree with these two guys? No. I've been pretty clear about where my political leanings are this particular election, and they're not with Donald Trump. But I am just absolutely, absolutely floored by the vitriol that has been directed at these two gay guys by the gay community. I must say, maybe I'm a little bit on my soapbox here for a second, I'm really disappointed. People are saying horrible, horrible things. You know, I get the whole idea behind it. Of course I do. And there's a part of me that absolutely agrees. Like, how could you possibly be LGBTQ and be supporting this particular candidate, right? Like, I don't agree with them in any conceivable way. But the lengths at which we will go to say horrible things about these two guys, I just do think that is beneath us. Saying that, well, they clearly have mental health issues. And that's what I keep reading over and over again, that they have mental health issues. They must have mental health issues in order to be betraying the LGBTQ community, to be so self-hating that they would be supporting the Republican candidate for president. And I think that it's lazy. That's what I'm going to say right now. I think that a lot of these critiques are just plain lazy. Saying that these two guys have mental health issues, first of all, perpetuates the stigma around mental health. And I just think that's not the way to go. I think that we actually do need to take a few minutes and understand why this support is there for Donald Trump on behalf of members of the LGBTQ community. It doesn't mean that we agree with them. But we are not a community that says you must vote this way. We are a community that wants to understand the issues, or at least should want to understand the issues to get why individuals do want to support the Republican candidate for president. So, I don't know. I've just been reading all the vitriol. I've been reading all the attacks on these two guys, and I just think it's horrible. And I don't particularly love when we turn on our own in this way. Right? Even as I'm saying this right now, I feel like there's a part of me screaming, well, you're a hypocrite because you support the absolute takedown of Milo Yiannopoulos. And I do. I absolutely do not think that the LGBTQ community should be spending time, particularly in our media, our own magazines, devoted to extolling the virtues or even giving Milo Yiannopoulos column width. But that to me is completely different. That is wholesale destruction of our community. These are just two guys who are in Cincinnati at a rally supporting their candidate for president. They're not trying to take down the rest of us. I get that many of you think, well, by supporting this candidate, it indirectly does that. I get that, but that's not a reason to take them down. That's a reason to engage them in conversation. Someone like Milo Yiannopoulos, no reason to engage him in conversation whatsoever. None at all. So there's that. Speaking of the election, prominent Trump-backing radio host Dennis Prager has claimed that it is a left-wing lie to say that straight people get HIV. Huh. The nationally syndicated radio talk show host, who is an outspoken supporter of Donald Trump, made the claims at the Western Conservative Summit. In the clip snipped by Right Wing Watch, which is an organization that does great work at holding people accountable, Prager fumed about the hysteria surrounding straight people getting AIDS. He said this, quote, "The left has a monopoly, almost a monopoly on hysteria, and I will give you a few examples of the hysterias of your lifetime." One was heterosexual AIDS in America. Do you remember that? When we were told by Time and Newsweek and the New York Times, remember when they said AIDS doesn't discriminate? Well, that was a lie. AIDS does discriminate. It happens to attack in America overwhelmingly gay men and intravenous drug users and partners. You know the group least likely to get AIDS? Gay women. So it can't be homophobic to say the truth. The truth is not a left-wing value. This was a hysteria. Heterosexual AIDS in America was a hysteria. So disappointing to be putting views like this out there, my friends. And so, hey, if you find yourself engaged in a conversation with the gay couple from Cincinnati who went to the Donald Trump rally, this is a great topic to say, hey, this is who you are allying yourself with. These are members of the Republican Party. This is an outspoken supporter of Donald Trump. How do we ally ourselves with these folks? Great topic of conversation, but not attacking that couple. And by the way, here is another reason to speak with that Cincinnati couple. Talk to them about Donald Trump's newest statements about appointing more ultra-conservative justices to the Supreme Court. What a great topic to engage them on. Mr. Trump had previously told evangelicals he would consider a push to overturn same-sex marriage via the appointment of new Supreme Court justices. During the second presidential debate, Donald Trump confirmed that he would appoint justices in the mold of the late Antonin Scalia, who opposed the decriminalization of sodomy and penned a blistering dissent against the equal marriage ruling. He said this, Donald Trump said this, quote, Justice Scalia, great judge, died recently, and we have a vacancy. I'm looking to appoint judges very much in the mold of Justice Scalia. I'm looking for a judge, and I've actually picked 20 of them so that people would see the highly respected, highly thought of, and actually very beautifully reviewed by just about everybody, but people that will respect the Constitution of the United States. I think this is so important. Well, Right Wing Watch, that same organization that reported on the radio host I just spoke of, they also did their research to uncover that nearly every one of these Supreme Court candidates that Trump has mentioned is an extreme anti-LGBT conservative. So, what a great topic. Hey, he would appoint justices that would try to take away rights already given to us and certainly not be in favor of granting us full equality, which we don't currently have. And when the conversion therapy case makes its way to the Supreme Court, which it will at some point, it's only a few states that ban this incredibly harmful practice, we do want a court that's going to stand with the side that says, hey, this therapy's really bad and it's doing harm and we can't allow it. Great topic of conversation. These are the real issues, not to demonize the people who support Donald Trump. It's not what we do. One of my favorite people on this planet, Judy Shepard. Judy Shepard, the mother of gay murder victim Matthew Shepard. She has condemned the hatred of Donald Trump's campaign in an ad. In 1998, just to remind you, and I go over this because I know that we have some younger listeners who don't exactly know who Matthew Shepard was. And it's so important that you know who Matthew Shepard was and who Judy Shepard is and who Dennis Shepard is and what they came to mean for so many of us. In 1998, 21-year-old student Matthew Shepard was tortured and left for dead by two men in Laramie, Wyoming. His death and the subsequent court case shocked America. It led to a push for hate crimes legislation that was spearheaded by his parents. Judy Shepard is the co-founder of the pro-LGBT Matthew Shepard Foundation. She spoke out against the hatred of Republican hopeful Donald Trump. In the advertisement, she said this, quote, I've seen what can happen as a result of hate. My son Matt was murdered in 1998. He was befriended by two men in a bar who pretended to be gay. They offered him a ride home, and when he was in their car, they robbed him and beat him. They drove Matt out to the prairie and tied him to a split rail fence, beat him some more, then left him for dead. In the aftermath of Matt's death, my family saw the best of America in the love and support we were shown. So when I see the hate that Donald Trump brings to his campaign for president, it terrifies me. Words have an influence. Violence causes pain. Hate can rip us apart. I know what can happen as the result of hate, and Donald Trump should never be our president. That's Judy Shepard. For long time listeners of this show Is So Gay, you'll know that Judy Shepard was our 100th episode guest. I mean, that was years and years ago, back when we were still in Brattleboro, Vermont, when folks were saying, oh, you got to get a big celebrity. You got to get a big celebrity for your 100th episode. And I just wanted someone who I respected and admired, and maybe not everyone knew her, but they certainly knew of her. And so when Judy Shepherd said, yes, I will be on your show, that was such a big deal. And that was one of those episodes where I have absolutely no idea how I kept it together. I really have no idea how I kept it together, because for so many of us, and I am at the top of this list, Matthew Shepherd and I were the same age, and when he was murdered, and I too was 21, 20 years old, coming out to my parents and really struggling with that process, for so many of us, Judy Shepherd, and it wasn't the choice that she made, right? Judy Shepherd did not choose to become a woman in the spotlight. What horrible circumstances that thrust her into the spotlight. But for so many of us, Judy Shepherd became our mom. She became our mom in the media. She became our mom doing interviews saying, this is what happened to my son, and I don't want this to happen to anyone else's child. And for so many of us who needed that parental figure at that time, Judy Shepherd was it. So, unbelievably powerful advertisement. So I encourage you to check that out and hear her words, not just what I said to you, even though those are the words that she said, but hear it from her own voice. Let's turn tail. Let's talk about significantly lighter topics. Well, there is no place like home. And for the iconic pair of ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz, that's the Smithsonian, which has just launched a crowdfunding campaign to help preserve the shoes into the future. The museum has just launched a campaign on Kickstarter to help prevent the sequin slippers from deteriorating. They are looking for, apparently this is what it costs, $300,000 to accomplish this task. The shoes were worn by Judy Garland in 1939's The Wizard of Oz. They're beginning to show their age. According to the Kickstarter campaign, the color has faded and the slippers appear dull and washed out. The coating on the sequins that gives the shoes their hallmark ruby color is flaking off its gelatin base. Some threads that hold sequins in place have broken. This is very upsetting. Gay community, we need to rally around this. We need to help buy and restore. We're not going to buy them, right? They're not going to ship us. That's not one of the perks from the Kickstarter campaign. We don't then get the ruby slippers. But if we chip in, this iconic symbol of the LGBT community in popular culture, the ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz, we can help restore them. The museum hopes to raise funds to first study the slippers and to identify the perfect conditions to conserve them in. Then they'll undergo a conservation treatment to clean and stabilize them before being in their new carefully designed display case. Well, there you go. Who knew that it would cost $300,000 to restore these ruby slippers? Perhaps you're like me thinking, couldn't we just spray paint them? But no, we cannot just spray paint them, because that would ruin the integrity of the shoes. $300,000, wow, that's a lot. So if you go to Kickstarter, you can find the hashtag #KeepThemRuby. #KeepThemRuby. And by the way, there are perks. If you donate $7,000, maybe some of you have that. If you donate $7,000, you can even get your own custom replica pair. So there are perks. There are perks. So help restore the ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz. Huh. A big coming out this week, Fox News anchor Shepard Smith. He has come out of the closet. He has denied that there was pressure to keep him in the closet as he quietly confirmed his sexuality. The journalist joined the Fox News Channel at its inception in 1996, and he remains with the conservative news network two decades later. He was previously married to a woman. He's avoided commenting on his sexuality for years, though he has previously been featured in Out Magazine's Power List and attended a National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association gala. In an interview with the Huffington Post, the anchor quietly confirmed his sexuality while denying allegations that he was booted out of his primetime slot by former Fox News president Roger Ailes because he wanted to come out publicly. He was asked if Roger Ailes had ever been homophobic, and Shep Smith said this, quote, "No, never. He treated me with respect, just respect. I wasn't new in the business when I came here. I'd been doing reporting for 12 years, but I wasn't old in it either. And he gave me every opportunity in the world, and he never asked anything out of me but that we get it right, try to get it right every day. It was a very warm and loving and comfortable place." He also said this directly to reports that he was kept in the closet, quote, "That's not true. He was as nice as he could be to me. I loved him like a father." So a lot of the response to Shep Smith coming out was very, oh yeah, we knew that already. We knew that already. Or why didn't he come out earlier? Yeah, but Shep Smith is going to come out when he comes out, and this is when he came out, and here you go. I'm okay with this one. People come out when they want to come out. The people I struggle with are the politicians who are trying to pass anti-gay legislation, who then come out, and I'm thinking, well, gosh, I'm not really a fan of anyone being outed, but you actively used your power to suppress the LGBTQ community, so not a huge fan of people saying, oh, all right, this person did no harm, they can come out whenever, because those people did harm. It's possible that Shep Smith covered some stories that very much did not help the LGBTQ community. I don't know his work super well. I've certainly seen him, as many of us have, on TV. I don't know in particular that he has furthered an anti-LGBTQ agenda. So whatever, this is when Shep Smith came out. This is when Shep Smith came out. All good. So one of my favorite parts about doing this part of the show every week is that it forces me to stay on top of the news. And there's a lot going on out there that I had absolutely no idea was going on. Like if you said to me, hey, can't the gay people get married everywhere? I would have said, yes, gay people can get married everywhere because, you know, the Supreme Court had that historic decision that said gay people can get married everywhere. Turns out, folks, no. There are still places in the United States where gay people still cannot get married. I did not know that. 8 Alabama counties are still flatly refusing to issue any marriage licenses after they axed the provisions over same-sex marriage. So a little bit of history. Same-sex weddings began in Alabama in January of 2015 after a lower court battle, which was months ahead of the Supreme Court ruling that brought marriage equality to all 50 states. So at the time, a number of counties in the state of Alabama attempted to resist the ruling. They opted to cease offering marriage licenses to all couples, straight or gay. Well, nearly 2 years later, some reporters followed up with representatives of the 15 holdout counties that have stopped issuing marriage licenses, and they found that eight of the state's 67 counties are still continuing their resistance to the equality measure. Debbie Owens, the chief clerk of Washington County, said this, quote, "We do not issue marriage licenses because our judge chose not to. It's our judge's choice," end quote. So gay people can't get married there. Straight people can't get married there either. And so maybe you're listening and thinking, well, this isn't a gay thing. No one can get married there. Yeah, this was created to prevent gay people from getting married. In none of these instances did they say, we just don't want anyone to get married whatsoever. That did not happen with any of these locales. It happened because people said, no way. Absolutely not. We do not want gay people getting married here. So if you gay people can get married, then nobody gets married. And in 8 counties in the state of Alabama, no one can get married. It's unbelievable. I did not know that that was still going on. But that is still going on in the United States, in Alabama. Back to some political news. Republican Senator Ted Cruz is apparently worried that Hillary Clinton will make gender reassignment mandatory. Huh. Ted Cruz, who came second to Donald Trump in the Republican primaries earlier this year, is on the extreme anti-LGBT wing of the Republican Party. This week, he tweeted a link to an article which warned about the impact of a Hillary Clinton administration. The Conservative Review article, which was written by Daniel Horowitz, stated this, quote, "By 2020, we will have mandated sex change operations, heck, our own military during a time of war, an internal morale crisis has already published a handbook on sex changes. We simply don't have the time to continue down this failed path. We've already been in the wilderness for 27 years. So Ted Cruz promptly deleted the article. It's just so bizarre that you would retweet things like this without checking, hey, what's this all about? What am I putting out there here? Am I really retweeting something that says that Hillary Clinton, that electing her is going to cause there to be mandatory gender reassignment surgeries? Really? What the heck are we talking about here? Retweeting. I know that people put on their Twitter feeds, just because I retweet doesn't mean I endorse it. Yeah, but you should probably read it. You should probably read it. I'm giving Ted Cruz an out. I'm giving him the out that maybe he didn't read it, the full article. But I don't know. It seems really irresponsible. Across the seas, the UK government has announced that thousands of gay and bisexual men who were convicted under historic anti-gay laws will be posthumously pardoned. This is a good thing. This is a step to reconcile so much hurt that was caused years and years ago. Justice Minister Sam Gyimah, he announced the fulfillment of a 2015 Conservative Party manifesto pledge, which will see men convicted for consensual same-sex relationships formally pardoned. Computing World War II hero, codebreaker Alan Turing, he was convicted of gross indecency in 1952. He was previously granted a one-off posthumous royal pardon in 2013. However, the new law will disregard the offenses of thousands of other men. This minister in England said the government would seek to implement the change through an amendment to the Policing and Crime Bill. Anyone living who has been convicted of these now abolished offenses could already apply through the Home Office to have their names cleared and criminal records expunged under a process introduced by the coalition government's 2012 Protections of Freedoms Act. Look, we don't have a time machine, folks. We do not have that technology yet. It almost just became a gay sci-fi show, but we don't. We don't have the technology to go back and change these laws and apologize to people and to make sure that this didn't happen way back then. So all we can do now is move forward in a way that honors the inherent humanity of these individuals who were so horribly persecuted. So horribly persecuted. Certainly having a big, big movie about Alan Turing helped bring a lot of attention here, but there are thousands of other people that we don't even remotely know their names, whose lives were destroyed by the persecution of governments around the world who said, no, 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 you absolutely cannot be gay. That is indecency. That is against our code. And so we will prosecute you and destroy your life and your family's life. So this is absolutely a step in the right direction. So kudos to you in England. Over in Paris, thousands of people marched in Paris this week to call for the repeal of the law which legalized same-sex marriage. Marchers also protested against the use of assisted reproduction techniques and surrogate mothers to enable same-sex couples to have children. Police estimated the crowd at 24,000, while organizers gave a figure of 200,000. That's quite a gap between those two. That often happens. So, big protest there in Paris. Not sure if it will lead to any change, but folks not happy about the progress of the laws there in Paris. Whether it's 24,000 or 200,000, it's important to know that people have really strong feelings, and we should address those feelings. Not by changing the law, but at least I'm all for people protesting. I like protests. Doesn't mean that we make all the changes because people protest, but people need to be able to say, hey, I have a voice here. I'm okay with people having a voice, even those gays for Trump. In Philadelphia, the owner of the gay bar Eye Candy made headlines last month after he was caught on camera using racial slurs. Since the footage of Daryl DiPiano from 2013 was released, racial tensions in the gay neighborhoods in Philadelphia have boiled over, and LGBT residents are calling for action. Black LGBT patrons in the city say they have been carded at clubs, have to wait for drinks for longer amounts of times than their white counterparts in the clubs, and have to meet strict dress codes that ban athletic wear, Timberland boots, and hooded sweatshirts. These residents say the video provides evidence of their concern and are now calling for safer spaces for the Black LGBT community. Shawnee Akila Robin, who is the creator of the Black and Brown Workers Collective, said this quote, "The minute you walk into the gayborhood as a Black or Brown person, you feel it. They play our music and target us for the very Blackness they're making money off of. This is the reality of being Black and queer in America." I want to read that again. This is Shawnee Akila Robin, creator of the Black and Brown Workers Collective, and they held protests. Shawnee said this quote, "The minute you walk into the gayborhood as a Black or Brown person, you feel it. They play our music and target us for the very Blackness they're making money off of. This is the reality of being Black and queer in America." I will be the first person to say there's no possible way that I have done even remotely enough to feature the experience of being Black and queer in America on this radio show over the past 8 years. But we have to take these moments to say, guys, we have to show up for everyone. This can't just be about the LGBTQ community and we don't drill down to see, wait, there's issues within this community, because there are racial divides in this community. And not talking about them, that actually doesn't work. That's not a thing. Ignoring that these things are happening, that doesn't create any change. And change is so desperately needed. So I've certainly said it quite a few times, but I could say it so many more times than I have. And by the way, I will say, if you guys have any suggestions for guests, please send them on over. I would love to be covering more the intersection of race and sexual orientation. But again, we have to talk about race. We have to talk about racial equality. That intersection of racial equality and sexual orientation is one that we are not all standing at the crosswalks. And we all have to do more. It is so important. We have to lift each other up. We have to work on what it means to be anti-racist, because it will lift us all up. It will make us a stronger community. There's more you guys can do. You got to figure out what it is that you do, though, to make a difference. Whether you are writing a young adult novel that I love, again, It Looks Like This. Our huge thanks to Rafi Mittelfeldt. What an amazing book. I encourage you, implore you to go check it out. Whether you want to host your own podcast and you need some advice, send me an email, ken@thisshowisogay.com. Whatever it is that you do to use your voice to make a difference for the entire LGBTQ and ally community, you gotta get out there and do it. I push you to this every week, and it's just all about taking one step. Do something either on this day or tomorrow. I'll give you a 24-hour grace period to use your voice to make a difference. One step, send an email to the editor of your local paper. Send an email to a politician. It could be as simple as that, or it could be starting a conversation with someone else in your life about any of the issues that we talk about here. It really makes a difference. So get out there, folks. Go use your voice to make a difference. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay? Yeah.